I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I would put my guest, now Brad Levine's newest book, on a list of the best Canadian political books written from the unique perspective of an insider. In Building the Orange Wave, the inside story behind the historic rise of Jack Layton and the NDP, we have a new look. We have a look now at how the New Democratic Party evolved in the nearly 10 years that Layton was at its helm. It is a definitive account of how the party made it from fourth place to official opposition in the historic election of 2011, and provides a marvelous insight into what Jack Layton was like as we follow him from Toronto City Councillor, failed NDP candidate, then leader of the official opposition, only to die later in 2011. Brad Levine was there throughout. He was out here in British Columbia at the turn of the century working in the provincial government, noticing that the NDP needed renewal federally and that Jack Layton was the person to do it. Brad Levine is Vice President of Public Affairs at Hill and Knowlton Strategies in Ottawa. He was the NDP's campaign director in the 2011 election campaign. He served as Principal Secretary and Director of Strategic Communications for Mr. Layton, and also served as Communications Director and National Director for the New Democratic Party. You can see him regularly on the CBC News Network's Power and Politics broadcast. This book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. The foreword is by Olivia Chow. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Brad Levine. Mr. Levine, good morning.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So you're traveling across this country hawking this book of yours, and I'm sure you're getting a lot of nice memories from folks about your leader, Jack Layton.
There's so many good memories, folks that had worked with him along the way, as well as folks that felt that they knew him even though they might not have shaken his hand.
Yeah.
A lot of warm memories for the man.
Yeah, and so you had great access to the papers, even the emails of Jack Layton, in the course of writing this book. How important was it for you to write this story down now?
Oh, I think it was very important. It was one of the kind of the compelling reasons why I decided to write it. I don't see myself as an author, more as somebody who had a unique position behind the scenes for all those years. Using Jack Layton's emails, having access to his personal files, as well as dozens and dozens of interviews with individuals who worked at various stages of his time as a federal leader, gave, I think, some really keen insight and some unique perspective as to how politics is practiced in the modern age.
Yeah, what you've done in this book is taken us into the NDP, and we see how successful it was in that 2011 campaign. But also gives us a view of what it was like beforehand, especially in the 90s and the 2000s, and you see what kept it out of office and why it was so unsuccessful. So what did Jack Layton do for the fourth place party, the NDP, nationally, through to his candidacy to 2002 and then his winning the leadership after? I mean, something changed in the party, and I guess we can blame Jack Layton for that, right?
Yes, I'm sure he would welcome that that blame. But, you know, we sat around his dining room table in his downtown Toronto home back in 2002, and we knew that it was going to take what we consider the long game. We affectionately termed this undertaking as the project, and we knew that we had to do a lot of work. You know, one of the things that Jack asked the team around him was to go off and find where they are practicing politics, political party work, the best. Doesn't matter what partisan shape they take, but if somebody's got a good idea on how to fundraise or organize grassroots or databases and micro-targeting, do it. And so he gave those around him tremendous leeway to go and find the best practices within the parameters that he'd set out, the goals that he set. Now, we always knew that it was going to happen, but I'll be honest with you, didn't think it was going to be that fast. But we had four elections in 7 years, and that's quite rare in Canadian politics. So we were in a perpetual campaign, and we've gotten quite good at what we practiced. Normally that would have taken about 16 or 20 years. We were able, because of the short election periods, do it in just under seven.
And my sense is, from the book, is that he had the vision, or the foresight, if you will, that the NDP could govern one day, that he was running to be Prime Minister, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, when I first went to Ottawa with Jack Layton in 2003, just after he won the leadership, we would talk about governing. And a lot of folks within the NDP at that time said, don't talk about that. That's not what people are drawn to. Let's just keep quietly building. And Jack and the team around him made the point, you know what, you can't apply for the third place position. You go for prime minister, and it took a long slog, but eventually, because of that vision that he had, we got there. Now, I also, coming from the province of British Columbia, we know that the Democratic Party can govern. We had other folks from Saskatchewan and Manitoba who felt the same way. Jack spent 20 years on city council, and there's a line in the book that I used, and I'll never forget him saying that. He says, look, I didn't come here to Ottawa as federal leader to make good points and win debates. I came here to make change, and you can't make change if you don't govern.
Yeah. But by the way, whose idea was it first, that Leighton run? Was it yours or Rob Fleming's?
Well, you know, there was I share that story in the book that Rob Fleming and I were sitting at a pub in Victoria just after the 2000 election campaign, and we were looking for who the next leader could be, and we were looking for some key attributes, somebody who would govern, somebody who was bilingual, somebody who came from urban Canada. And so we started to talk about Jack Layton. Now, he sent that email to Jack Layton the next day, and a number of months later, Jack got back to us very interested. But I also weave in the other parts of the story where there was other people who were talking to Jack in Toronto at the same time. So I certainly won't take the credit, but I will. We were part of it, but we weren't the only part.
But by the way, do you think he'll run for the NDP leadership here in BC?
You know, I don't know. I think we'll have a better sense after the convention that's coming up, but we'll have to wait and see.
The other thing that's a great political strategy that we learn about in your book is how media savvy Leighton was. That even though he didn't have a seat in the House when he first became leader of the NDP, he still managed to get on the nightly news. We get his name in print in the sort. As I told you before we started, he appeared on this program twice. He talked to everyone. I guess that was something that you thought was useful.
Well, absolutely. I mean, yeah. when you're the fourth party and you've only got 13 seats, you don't turn down any media. That certainly was the case in the early days. But at one level it was also to his advantage, because the more he did interviews, the better he got at communicating the message. So it was like a training ground. Think of it as the minor leagues, where you're grinding it out, practicing every day a lot of the times. While the other leaders were, let's say, less adaptable to various media. Jack had come from, years in City Hall, so he knew the media well. But at the federal level, it was a lot different, the media. The questions that you get, the need to be very well briefed on your files, because if you say something wrong, as we've seen recently in federal politics, it can really blow back on you. And it was a good training ground for Jack to do that, to be hungry for the media. So much so that in the last days of the 2011 campaign, it was the first time in the 10 years I was with Jack where we actually declined media interviews and didn't make them available to the media. That was at a time when we were flying very high in the polls.
Yeah. Now, he was great in the debates that he appeared in federally during the four election campaigns that you mentioned earlier. But he wasn't always like that. I mean, in the book, he showed you a video of him in the 91 mayoralty race, right, where he wasn't as good. And I guess, well, what did you advise him in terms of how to present himself and made him as good as he was on TV as he turned out to be?
Well, it was funny. We were sitting in his living room watching this old tape from the 1991 Toronto mayoralty, and he knew that he wasn't the best he could be. He knew that he needed to improve on it. And we actually went in this direction in the 04 and less so, but the 06 one as well, where we would beef him up with all these binders full of information and stats and all this stuff on the expected questions. And we'd have like 12, 15, 20 people in the room all kind of throwing in their 2 cents. And what happened was, of course, when the lights came on at the TV debate in 2004, he couldn't remember any of those stats. He couldn't remember any of the things that all these people were talking about. So it took a couple of election campaigns to get him comfortable. We threw out all the binders. That's a true story. We didn't worry about stats. We didn't worry about little nuggets of information. What we worried about were the messages that we believed would resonate with people at home, regular folks, and he just put those on the cards, on those little cards that he had on his podium, and it was his best performance in 2011, and it was the one that he practiced the least.
Really? Yeah. Message tracks. That's something that you talk about in the book, that there was a message track for English Canada and then for Quebec, and people cynically during the campaign would say that he was telling Quebecers one thing that he wouldn't say elsewhere. Did he? And I guess it did work, didn't it?
Well, to answer your first question, no. He said the exact same thing in both languages and in all regions of the country.
Okay.
That's first and foremost. You don't get away with saying one thing in one part of the country because the media that you're traveling with, some are from Quebec, some are from BC, they're going to call you out on it. That, I think it's one of the things that your opponents say when they don't have much else to say. But as for the two-track messaging, and you know, Canada is a very big country. It's comprised of a lot of regions, and there's a lot of different political cultures throughout the country. That doesn't mean that you say one thing in one place and another in another, but it does mean that you need to focus your messages in different ways. Obviously, in the province of Quebec, where the Bloc Québécois held 50-odd seats out of 75, you needed to know that. You don't have to say that in British Columbia, where it's just a couple of Liberals, a handful of the Democrats, and the rest is Conservative. So you're going to be positioning yourself differently in those two markets, if we want to compare the two. But there was, a really smart strategy that we had developed in Quebec where you couldn't badmouth Gilles Duceppe, the leader, and you couldn't badmouth the Bloc Québécois because they had become such a vital part of their society in their mind, even those that didn't vote for them. So instead of talking about the vehicles of how people voted, we talked about the outcomes. And that is, if people voted for the Bloc because they wanted to get out of Afghanistan or wanted action on climate change, we would ask them, you know, how are we doing on those files, right? With knowing full well that they would say, well, of course, we haven't done anything. So we came up with this concept of what if we worked together and worked together with the rest of Canada and worked to get rid of Stephen Harper. And that's why you saw, you know, in Federalist areas, in separatist areas, Francophones, Anglophones, first-generation Canadians, they all liked that. They wanted to turn the page on the old constitutional bickering that was represented by the Liberals and the Bloc. And they wanted, you know what they wanted? They wanted more doctors. They wanted better jobs. They wanted a better future for their kids. So we went into Quebec and we said that. And we also said that precisely in the province of British Columbia.
Yeah. So I guess foremost in people's minds is whether the NDP can hold on to its seats in Quebec. I mean, some people are saying that it's a one-off, that this was just this was Jack Layton. More than anything that got a large number of seats in Quebec. I mean, do you think Thomas Mulcair in the next election can hold on to the seats in Quebec?
Absolutely. I think that the team is doing an outstanding job in the province of Quebec. And, you know, it's funny because I've spent the last 5 or 6 days touring throughout British Columbia, and it's the number one question that I get when we do our forums with on the tour. Is talk to us about Quebec. What's going on in Quebec? People are interested in that, which I found quite, to be honest, I found it quite surprising. I thought folks in BC would want to talk more about BC politics than Quebec politics. But nonetheless, there's an eye to what's happening in Quebec. I mean, right now, the New Democrats hold 57 seats out of 75 in the province of Quebec. We're number one in the polls there and have traditionally, consistently been riding high in the polls. So, you know, I'm very bullish. I think that Tom Mulcair, if people, once they get into the campaign, once they focus, who do they want as their next prime minister? What attributes are they looking for? I think that they're gonna see that he's got the leadership and the strength that this country needs to set it on the right course and to take on Stephen Harper. This is more than just a first-time job that you can apply for. It's more than just being an interesting personality. This is a big job, and it's a serious one, and I think Mulcair's got the attributes required.
Now, you say also in the book that one of the goals for the New Democratic Party now and for Mr. Mulcair is to build in the suburbs. Can the NDP do that, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the next election will be decided in suburban Ontario, as well as in the West. His first job is to hold on to Quebec and then grow in those regions. So, you know, I do believe so. I mean, you take a look at all the suburban seats that we currently hold in English Canada. We just need to make sure that we don't leave any seats uncontested, and that we go in there and we take on the Conservatives quite forcefully. But if you take a look at what's on the minds of those that are living in suburban Canada, by and large, of course, everyone is different. But you know, people are worried about, you know, making ends meet. They're worried about infrastructure, traffic, climate change, their children's future. These are all things right within the wheelhouse of Tom Mulcair and the NDP. So I do believe that people can. I think we're in an era of non-traditional voters. That is, who you voted for in the past. Maybe some folks vote the same way because their dads or their moms did, or their grandparents. I believe that we're in an era of people are kind of comfortable looking around, hold the group that we got in 2011, and then find that next tier, which I think, by and large, lives in the suburbs.
Now, one of the things that this book is really great at is it takes us into what it was like behind the scenes. And I think foremost in people's minds, the speculation as to Jack Layton's health from 2010 onwards, especially in that 2011 campaign. I mean, there was talk when Harper's budget came out in 2011 that there wasn't going to be an election because Layton was concerned about his health even then. Mm-hmm. That's not true, right?
No, that's not true. And you know, I remember Jack was answering the question at the time, and the doctors gave him a clean bill of health. His family gave him all the support that he needed, and once he made up his mind, then we went for it. But the cancer that ultimately took his life, he didn't start feeling those effects, as I say in the book, until July in the filibuster. On the right to work or the back to work legislation.
This would be after the election, I guess, of May of 11, right?
A handful of weeks after the election. So it's not true that he was ill going into that election campaign. There was some stiffness from his hip surgery, but that was unrelated to the cancer.
Yeah, people assume that him using a cane had to do with some sort of bone cancer or something like that. That's unrelated, right?
Oh, absolutely. That was there as a precaution. Again, if you recall, he had when the budget was tabled, I recall him on crutches that his doctors had told him to use, and then his healing was going so well that the doctor said, "Well, you can drop the crutches now and just use the cane." And the cane became a symbol. I think it was a very potent symbol. It wasn't a plan, by the way. It wasn't something that we were trying to exploit in any political way. It was just him defying his critics, fighting cancer. Like, millions of Canadian families are touched by cancer every year, and people could relate to the fight back of saying, "I'm gonna beat this this prostate cancer that he was diagnosed with the year prior." So you know that cane became that symbol of that fight back and that defiance, and I think it's one of the qualities that people most admired of him.
And even at the end, you thought, seeing him for the last time, that he would beat this, right?
Absolutely. The last words I said to him was, "I'll see you in 2 weeks," because we were going to come down to Toronto and visit with him in 2 weeks, and I never once wavered. And the reason why I always believed that he would beat this is because spending, you know, just 10 short years with him, even though we worked very closely, it was, you know, a fraction of his life, you know, he would always overcome these great obstacles, right? When, you know, in the book I talk about how, you know, he comes to us in the early days and he says, "I want to buy a building so that the party can have an asset against which to borrow." And we all shook our heads and said, "That's crazy. We don't even have, you know, we can barely pay the rent. You want to go buy?" And he pulled it off, and he pulled it off in record time. And you know, I want to negotiate a budget with the Liberals, you know, but we don't have the balance of power. It'll never happen. And he did it.
Yeah.
And time and time again, the coalition in 2008, and you know, he defied us. And then he says, you know, I need to take some time off. I'm very sick. And I just said, well, of course he's going to beat this. Just as he's beaten all the odds in the past, he'll beat these again. And it wasn't until Anne McGrath, the chief of staff to Mr. Layton, phoned me on the morning that he had passed away, that I was truly coming into the understanding that he had gone.
Now, in the book, you write about Jack and Olivia wondering what to do with their careers, I guess, at the in the late 90s and the early 2000s. 11 years ago, she thought of running for mayor of Toronto. Let's say she does next year. Is she a lock to win?
Well, I don't think there's any locks in the city of Toronto these days. That political climate is just, it's quite a drama. That's why so many people are paying attention. But, you know, I hope that she gives it serious consideration. Obviously support her in any decision that she makes. I don't live in Toronto, so I'm not on the ground there. But I think she'd be a tremendous mayor if she does decide to run and go for it. But as you know, you can't take anything for granted in that city. It's a very large city. It's got a tremendous amount of political cultures, and you got to kind of thread the needle. And it also depends on how many other people are running. You know, Mr. Ford won not because a majority of Torontonians supported him, but because enough people were trying to run against him. Who divided the non-Ford vote. So there's going to be a lot of factors as to whether or not she can win. But if she does decide to do it, I will support her, and I'm confident that she will give it her all, as she does to everything she does in life.
Now, why didn't the Orange Wave work out here in BC last May?
Fundamentally different party, fundamentally different place, different leadership, different approach to politics. The two parties are connected in name and in legacy and in membership, the way in which their outlook towards campaigns are quite different. And it's, you know, yeah, I came out for the BC election in May to help out, it was nothing like what the kind of work that we had been doing in 2000 leading up to 2011. Just a fundamentally different way of going about politics.
The other interesting thing in the book is as I said earlier on, you had access to Layton's emails, and you reproduce some of them in the book with permission, of course, from the senders. Mm-hmm. One was Lorraine Harper. And I was quite struck by her email. I guess she's not that religious, is that right?
Well, it was a very touching email, and I think that one of the reasons why I wanted to include it, and I was so appreciative that she allowed me, was because, you know, we look at Ottawa and we look at politics and we think that we're all out to scratch each other's eyes out, and we're out there to knock each other off. But there's also a human element that we're all, even though if we're in different political parties, we're human to each other. And I thought that was a touching moment. I think that what she was trying to say is that the line was, get well soon, Jack, you're in our hearts and in our prayers. Well, my heart, my husband's prayers.
Yeah.
I think that she was just trying to say that that she had a in her heart she was... she was showing the love that that she was expressing, and she was at the state funeral in Toronto there at Roy Thomson Hall, and it was just nice to see her and Mr. Harper there, and they were Mr. Harper immediately granted a state funeral to Olivia Chow on the same day that Jack died, which is, as you'll know, is very rare. It's normally restricted to governors general, cabinet ministers, prime ministers, never leaders of the official opposition, but he made an exception, and I think that is worthy of note.
Because you're a pundit, and you know politics in and out, did you play the what-if game, say if Layton were alive today, what it would be like in Ottawa? Do you think the tone would be different, say?
You know, one of the lessons that we try to instill in each other is never speculate. It was one of the things we used to try to get Jack. Jack would always get these, what if, Jack? What if this person did that and that person did this? What then would you do? And it took a little while, but he finally stopped the speculation games. You know, it's just too difficult. But I do know, I'll say this, because this is something I do think and I do know, is that the place is already different because of him. You know, the official opposition is comprised of 100 members of parliament. It takes up most of the opposition benches. There's a few independents and of course, a handful, a couple dozen liberals. But the heckling that used to be a hallmark of question period has changed a lot. I was just actually in question period from the observation seats, and you know, there was a bit more better tone, I would say, and that's directly related to him. He brought that in that decorum after the May 11 election, and I think he's also given folks an opportunity to see what a real leader's like, somebody who looks for the good in everybody, somebody who's in it for the right reasons, somebody who's got the eye on the ball, and I think that can serve as an inspiration to future leaders. So I think his legacy is significant.
And you have that in this book. This is such a great book, Brad, one that I suspect a lot of people will be reading for years to come. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much for your time today.
The book is called Building the Orange Wave, the Inside Story Behind the Historic Rise of Jack Layton and the NDP. It's from Douglas and McIntyre. Brad Levine joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.